Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of the Dissenter. I'm your host, as always, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Elmar Unstensson. He is an assistant professor and Ad Astra Fellow at University College Dublin, School of Philosophy. He works on topics in philosophy of language, philosophy of mind, history of analytic philosophy, metaphysics, philosophy of linguistics and cognitive science, and today we're focusing on his book, Talking About an Intentionalist Theory of Reference. So, Dr. Unstensson, welcome to the show. It's a big pleasure to everyone.
Great, yeah, thanks. Thanks for inviting me. I'm happy to be here.
Okay, so actually, I think that I haven't talked with any philosopher on the show about the topic we're going to cover today. So, to start off with, tell us a little bit about what are theories of reference. What is reference exactly?
That's a very good question. Basically, I don't think there is a very good theory neutral way to explain what a theory of reference is. But at a first stab, you could say something like, well, we might wonder exactly what the relationship is between words and objects, such mm-hmm. that the words can refer to those objects. So it seems like I can say the name Barack Obama right now, and by doing so, refer effortlessly, quickly, very efficiently to a certain individual, and I can expect you to understand who that individual is. So that's a rough characterization of the sort of question that we want to answer or at least address with the theory of reference. We want to explain how this is possible. But, you know, on a more theoretical level, for me at least, I think we should address this kind of question by thinking about the cognitive and communicative capacities of humans. So we sort of try to answer questions about reference in terms of broader questions about our capacity for successful communication with language or with other tools at our disposal.
But it's one thing to refer to something, but then there's the speech act of referring, right? So what is that exactly about? What are you referring to when you talk about the speech act of referring?
Well, so I guess one way to think about this is that I'm placing my own theory within the framework of what's sometimes called speech act theory. Mm-hmm. And within that framework, it is a sort of weird thing to think about the speech act of reference as a speech act at all. So at a bare minimum, what I think is that there are probably at least three types of speech acts, which are, you know, have certain dedicated clause types in all natural languages, which is something like assertion, direction or imperatives, and questions. There might be more, there might even be less, I'm not quite sure. But those are at least associated with specific kinds of speech acts. So when mm-hmm. I assert, a plausible thing to say is that I want you to believe something, the thing that I assert or something. So what I'm sort of saying in the book that I wrote is that, well, you know, we can also define certain more part-like things, smaller things that contribute to the production of these kinds of speech acts, some of them and some not. And in particular, there is this kind of thing we do, which is a component part of many, for example, assertive speech acts, namely the intention to refer to a particular object. So it's a little bit artificial, but I think we should accept the artificiality of it because in the end, we want a sort of scientific explanatory theory of what reference is and its role in communication. And I think we should focus on the ways in which reference shows up or contributes to other bigger things like assertion or direction or things like that.
And so later in our conversation, we're going to get into the theory you present in the book. But there are different theories of speech acts. For example, in the book, you talk about conventionalism, intentionalism, functionalism, expressionism, and others. I mean, could you perhaps tell us a little bit about some of these theories? I don't know if you want to go through all of them, but perhaps some of the main ones, also for the audience to get a better understanding of what people are theorizing and the several different theories out there when it comes to speech acts.
Yeah, so here's the way I'm thinking about this. These are supposed to be frameworks or theories about the nature of speech acts. You know, what determines what a specific action actually is. So, what determines the fact that my particular utterance at a time constitutes an assertion rather than something else on a given occasion? And so, conventionalism is the theory that in order to assert something, I have to, perform an action in accordance with some convention that's enforced in the context or something like that, of that general sort. Intentionalism is sort of the view that in order to perform a specific type of speech act, all you need is to perform an action with a suite of intentions, and then you have to explain exactly what those intentions are. And functionalism is something like, with a very broad brush, the view that speech acts are individuated or constituted by performances of types of actions that have particular functions, biological functions, or then you have to say something about functions, obviously, as well. And then you mentioned something like expressionism and normativism. And there are, interesting questions there, whether they are necessarily so distinct from intentionalism and conventionalism. But one way to think about it is that expressionism is a little bit more simple than intentionalism because all you need is something like a performance which is caused or otherwise indicates some specific mental states that might just be, beliefs and not these more complicated things that I'm calling intentions. And the normativist might think something like, well, your action has to be subject to some norm or a set of norms. And the most famous theory here is sometimes thought of in terms of the knowledge norm of assertion. So, and those are all supposed to be theories that individuate speech acts. And what I sort of say in the book, or try to argue in the book, is that for many reasons we should go for a sort of marriage between intentionalism and functionalism. So I think there are these actions, communicative actions that we perform with a specific type of a mental state involving certain types of intentions, and those action types, they have certain functions. They serve certain functions. You can perform them well or badly, or you can perform them sort of functionally or dysfunctionally, I guess, is one way to put it. So these are the different theories, and I think you can marry these two frameworks together and get a lot of cool results from doing so. That's not a very conventional way of doing things. Mostly these have been so far, warring camps, Ruth Millikan on one side and maybe Grice on the other side, and they've normally been thought of as very opposing viewpoints. But I think you can sort of package these together. And for the other views, I would say, I want to explain the phenomena they point out. I think there are conventional speech acts in many many senses, actually, but I think you need an intentionalist slash functionalist story to explain what they are. And the same thing goes for even expressionism and normativism. I just don't think norms can be as a normativist thinks. And the expressionist, we probably will talk more about that later, but roughly, I just think they pinpoint a certain thing that happens, namely, my annoyance might cause me to express my annoyance in a certain sense, and that's definitely something that occurs. But we want a theory of what I've been calling pragmatic or communicative competence, which involves things like that in certain ways, but is more sophisticated in humans, at least.
And you've just mentioned there that we want a theory of human pragmatic competence. So, what is that exactly?
Well, that's a really interesting question that I've been thinking about more after the book, because that was more of a promissory note in some parts of the book, at least. And I'm thinking a lot about that still. But think about it, you can think about it this way. There is both like developmental, cross-linguistic, as well as audience-specific variation in the human capacity to communicate and in the human capacity to refer. So in the book, I try to focus more specifically on what we might call referential competence. We get better at this as we grow and mature, and this is evidenced by the fact that young children seem to assume their own perspectives egocentrically more than adults when they are communicating, designing utterances or interpreting utterances. And then, for example, we adults, human competent adults roughly, we seem to design our noun phrases, our words basically, with specific audiences in mind. So, I refer to Napoleon to you by just saying Napoleon, that's sufficient. But, when I talk to my 6-year-old, I'll need to say something like, a famous French military commander who is now deceased, his name was Napoleon, and things like that. And there are many examples like this. Like, for example, demonstrative reference using words like this and that. That system in us exhibits quite a lot of variation cross-linguistically in the degree to which these systems encode things like perspective or distance. And those are really interesting facts about variation. I don't really go into these types of considerations in the book because I'm sort of abstracting away from a lot of empirical data to try to focus on the capacity to perform an action with an intention to refer. So, you have this intention which is controlling and guiding your action. And when you're in different languages or in different developmental stages or whatever, you will perform different types of actions based on maybe, in a sense, the same intention. I just want to get you to think about Barack Obama or whatever. And for speakers who have a natural language, and I want to take young children into account very much, they are sort of speakers without natural language, this will often involve, very complicated processes of language production, selecting words, executing phonological instructions, and so on. And I think what I'm getting at with this response is just that I think there's a lot we can say which hasn't been said and which has a lot of interesting consequences for like very famous traditional philosophical puzzles about the very capacity just to perform actions with these types of intentions and thinking about the capacity in those terms. So yeah, that's roughly what I have to say about that.
So, another question. There's this thing called Frege's curse. So, what is that about? And in the particular context of what we're talking about here, what are some of the problems brought to the table through Frege's curse, basically his puzzles?
That's a really good question too. So I start the book by talking dramatically, maybe over dramatically, about what I'm calling Frege's curse. And what I identify as Frege's curse is roughly the following. He presented us with two puzzles. One is the puzzle about identity, and the other is the puzzle about opaque contexts, or when we use verbs like believes or says. And what I'm calling the curse is roughly the idea encouraged by Frege that whatever solves one of these puzzles has to help us solve the other puzzle. And his idea, and Phrygians afterwards followed him, of course, in doing this. His idea was to posit something he called sense, which is like another level of meaning, which is set apart from the level of reference. And I think this is a curse because it sort of led us down many different rabbit holes that haven't been very successful. But at the same time, I think it's one of the greatest blessings that Frege actually identified these two puzzles, because in the end, I think they do give us a window or some kind of access into a specific kind of mental state that has these interesting consequences. There is a reason why philosophers have been so infatuated by the puzzle cases that this sort of gives rise to, but I do think the reasons need to be, I don't know, theorized in new ways with respect to, or in terms of, you know, developing insights in cognitive science, for example. So yeah, I could say more about that, but I think I could go on for a bit too long.
Yes, but you mentioned there, for example, identity. In the book, you also talk about confusion and specifically about the problem of identity confusion. So could you tell us about that? What is that problem exactly?
Yeah, so one way to think about that is that I'm trying to generalize quite a lot from Frege's original puzzle about identity, and trying to say, well, there is actually a mental state that gives rise to these puzzles that we've been thinking about for such a long time. There is a mental state that makes us, for example, posit or believe in things like senses or modes of presentation, which are like non-referential aspects of meaning in a certain way. And what I say is, I'm just going to introduce a little bit artificially this label confusion for a mental state whereby a thinker takes one thing to be two or two things to be one. So that's the abstract way of identifying the mental state. And then I think there are at least two theories or models you might have to explain more carefully or in more detail what that mental state consists in. And I go into a lot of detail about exactly what I think we should say in that area. And that's going to matter for presenting the sort of theory of reference that I present, because that's important for me in order to identify the state that is interfering or making the proper function of reference somehow grind to a halt in certain cases.
And in trying to deal with this problem of identity confusion, in the book you talk about, for example, the belief model of identity confusion. So what is this model about, and do you think it helps us deal with the problem or not?
Yeah, so the belief model, which is sort of the model that I present as my model, basically says that confusion, as I just defined it in these two different ways, can be explained in terms of beliefs or belief-like states, at least. And basically, what I want to do is to argue that you literally have confused beliefs when you are confused, when you make the mistakes of the kind that I just mentioned. So in the book, for example, I use this toy example of confusion, which is an example of what I call combinatory confusion, which is a little different from the traditional Phrygian kind, which I call separatory confusion. But it's easier to get at the point by focusing on combinatory cases. And one case that I use is something like the following. You know, I have a daughter, I give her two teddy bears so that I'm able to wash one of them while she's playing with the other. And through, you know, many, many years, she never figures out that she had two of them, but she always interacted with them on a week by week basis. And she called her teddy bear Malcolm. But in fact, like, there are labels on them behind the ears, and one is actually called Bill and the other is called Biff. And so This is just a sort of example to help people get at the intuitive idea here, because what I want to say about my daughter, let's imagine she's 25 now and reminiscing about Malcolm. You can ask yourself, well, what is she referring to? And what is she thinking about when she thinks about Malcolm? Is she thinking about Bill or is she thinking about Biff? And in the end, I will argue like my main motivation in the end is to say, well, we don't actually know, or there isn't actually a clear-cut answer here. But what I also want to say in order to get there is that it is literally true of my daughter that she falsely believes that Bill is identical to Biff, right? And that's true even if she's never thought of Malcolm in terms of him being either Bill or Biff. She doesn't even have those names or whatever. So it's going to require some maneuvering to make that sound plausible, because I'm attributing then a belief to my daughter whereby, she doesn't even have the names that I used to identify the belief. But in the end, I think that's absolutely okay.
So in the book, at a certain point, you argue that in the kind of case you're developing in the book, to distinguish between representational states and representational acts. So what is the distinction there, and why do you think it's important to establish it?
Yeah, that connects up beautifully to what I just said about Malcolm and Bill and Biff, because the idea is roughly to say that if we make this distinction between what I'm calling representational states and representational acts, what we can argue is that confusion can be something like an unconscious or implicit belief. And that using that distinction, you can explain why that is so. And moreover, you can explain how confusion, as I'm defining it, then fits within a broader category of implicit or unconscious belief states. So the distinction is roughly something that's best described in terms of degrees of control. So I think I have only minimal control over my belief states, my representational state of belief. So if I see an apple in front of me and the conditions are normal or whatever, I will just have a belief that there is an apple in front of me. But you couldn't say that about my capacity or disposition to represent that state to myself or others. So I can lie and say there isn't an apple in front of me. So I can do it totally intentionally, but I can also do it unintentionally. The point being just that my level of control, the degree to which I have control over the representational acts, is just incomparable to the control I have over the belief state. And I think this doesn't sort of give us a theory of what implicit belief is or unconscious belief is, but it does help us characterize certain classes of cases, for example, certain types of self-deception and certain confused states. So it happens to be the case that my daughter believes that Bill is identical to Biff, but she lacks, in a certain sense, the conceptual resources to represent that belief in that way in her actions, like in the acts of representation that she has control over. But we still, as theorists, should posit that belief to explain her behavior and inferences and a lot of other things.
And so you mentioned implicit beliefs there. Why do we need to posit them here? I mean, what role exactly do they play?
Well, yeah, that's a really big question, really. I guess what I want to say about that is that we do posit beliefs and explicit beliefs. These are all things that we should think of in terms of postulating mental entities or operations or processes. in order to explain things.
Right.
I do think that philosophers in particular have for a long time been inclined to think of belief as conscious belief or as something like judgment. But if what I said before is true, namely that there is this interesting distinction between the representational acts that we perform and the representational states, and we only have control over one and not the other, it sort of starts to seem like the natural juncture or in nature or something like that is really between the acts and the states. That's sort of what I'm trying to argue in the book anyway. And judgment turns out to be something we control, or you know, it's a kind of action, even if it happens internally. And that makes it not very similar to belief, because belief is supposed to be this thing that we don't have control over. It's, you know, I still think belief is something that, you know, happens to us and can be very, you know, temporary or any or and things like that. But I don't think it's a type of action. So, you know, as I said, philosophers have said that what you sincerely say you believe is roughly what you believe. I don't think there's anything wrong with saying that. It's just that, you know, we also need a lot of other mental states, some of them unconscious, some of them implicit, to explain what happens in the mind. And I do think in the end that beliefs only have a very distant connection to behavior and communication. I should point out, though, that I try to not be too controversial on this point in the book itself, because the kind of picture that I assume is, just for sake of argument, sort of says, well, you know, this is true, there are these representational states, but they may have some important connections to behavior, because, you know, philosophers are still mostly interested in accounts where, you know, beliefs are things that dispose you to act in certain ways, and that's sort of very important to the their concepts of belief. I just think my argument sort of goes through, even if we allow something like that to be true at the same time.
So I think this should be a good point to go back to something we talked a little bit about earlier when we referred to expressionism and intentionalism. So what is the difference, or what are the main differences between expressionist versus intentionalist approaches to speaker meaning and speaker reference?
Well, yeah, the differences are very many. I want to be, you know, pluralistic, at least to the extent that I think expressionism does, you know, pinpoint something that's really there out in nature. Yeah. It's something that happens to non-human animals. They perform expressive actions, and humans do that too. So I think that's an important part of the story. It's something that Grice, the philosopher, one of the philosophers I'm engaging with very deeply in the book, would call a case of natural meaning. So, you know, one thing causes another, and that thing sort of has then the meaning or information carried over or something like that. And I think expressionism, the project of expressionism is to try to explain something like meaning or communication, mostly in terms of more simple things like that, causal correlations in nature. But what Grice pointed out, and I'm in agreement with him on this, is a certain other type of interaction, which is between the actions that we perform and the intentions with which we perform them. So it seems like the link between the evidence and what it is evidence of becomes very different when the evidence is in certain ways doctored. So I produce it for you intentionally, and you know that the evidence is produced for you now on this occasion. And that just makes things a little bit different. And it makes it different, for me at least, specifically, in that we will have to postulate more sophisticated cognitive machinery to explain how we become so good at performing communicative acts and interpreting communicative acts in this new context, where it seems like we are enmeshed in this structure of planning and intentions and overt communication. So yeah, I guess I can talk about that for a long time, but I don't want to alienate the expressionists because I think they are completely right about a lot of stuff. I just think that there's also this way to think about our project, namely a way in which just asks, how far should we go? Like, how sophisticated is this capacity? And I don't want to stop at the sort of expressive behaviors. I want to go all the way to the very, intentionally produced communicative behaviors.
Yeah, basically, if I understand it correctly, what you're trying to say, and particularly when we talked about the also the other theories out there, you're not completely excluding all of what they say. Some of the things they say you think are still useful, but perhaps you think that particularly when it comes to humans, there are other things that other aspects of cognition of reference that they don't particularly refer to and you think are important to consider here, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Thanks.
And so, getting into the last part of our conversation, tell us then about your theory of Edenic intentionalism.
Yeah, okay. I'll try to say something that makes sense sort of intuitively then. Like when I try to explain the Edenic theory or Edenic intentionalism near the end of the book, some of the bits become a little bit too technical, maybe for to explain right now, but we can think about it this way. So it seems like as speakers, we have certain goals or plans or motivations in producing speech acts or communicative acts at all. And it seems like sometimes things work out as planned and sometimes they don't. And we have all these strategies to repair or anticipate something that might go wrong. A funny example that people often take is the example of malapropism. So in a paper about this, I used the example from, I think it was John Kerry who gave a speech a long time ago. And he said something like, Wasabi is a dangerous sect. In that case, what he intended to say was that Wahhabi is a dangerous sect. And that's a good case to think about because, in that kind of case, we can clearly identify what the target was, and we can maybe even say that it's clear what he meant. And what he wanted to say, what he intended to say, but something went wrong. Like he had a target and he missed the target. And in the sort of empirical literature on speech production, people think about this a lot. And there are like many different ways in which things could go wrong. But the first stage of language production, utterance production, is sometimes called something like conceptualization or just intention formation. So what Edenic intentionalism says is, well, there is more to say about the failures that might occur at that very fundamental starting point of the process. And what I want to say is that at the level of intention formation itself, the forming of the intention, which is supposed to guide the process of speech production, things can fail in very specific ways. In particular, you can have a referential intention which fails to determine a single object, even if, in some much more broader sense, it was the speaker's goal only to form intentions which would determine a single object. So, in the cases where you are confused, think about, for example, my daughter trying to think about Malcolm. There is a sense in which the cognitive mechanism that she is relying on in order to perform those actions, they only function properly when the intention itself determines a single object, because she's trying to think about a single object. But something misfires along the way. And she, in some sense, doesn't manage to determine any object at all. And Edenic intentionalism basically says, well, you know, in those kinds of cases, what we should say is something like reference failed. That doesn't mean that, you know, communication failed or the interaction failed or the coordination failed. It might be such that you don't even notice it and it doesn't really matter. But those things apply to malapropisms too. We can often not notice them and it doesn't really matter. And we have these unconscious repair strategies. And I think a similar thing happens in these confusion cases too. So I just want to say, you know, philosophers have used these kinds of cases to argue for, you know, things or levels of meaning that we should generalize across all speakers in all contexts. And I'm saying, no, actually, we should just say that reference failed for more cases than you thought reference would fail. And a lot of people think that's very unintuitive. But, you know, I try to say, well, of course, I am trying to use reference here in a fairly technical sense. But of course, there need to be connections between the sort of ordinary normal way of talking and the technical way. So I get the point.
Right. And what are some of the main cognitive states and mechanisms that participate in Edenic intentionalism?
Right. So I guess I can pick and choose a lot of different things. I'll just try to talk about the simplest bits. So what I think is that there are at least two types of intentions that we need in order to get pragmatic competence up and running. One is something I call the effective intention. So when I say it's raining, I have an effective intention, namely I want to have a particular cognitive effect on you as my addressee. But I also have a signaling intention, which is sort of to make you aware that I have the effective intention. So I'm doing this complicated thing where I'm signaling to you that I am signaling to you. And this is supposed to play a part in explaining how communication can become so powerful as a tool of information exchange, because I can communicate to you very complicated thoughts and intuitions or emotions just by letting you know that that's what I'm trying to do. And you can either satisfy the effective intention or not. Namely, you can either form the belief that it is raining outside or not. So that's a bit of the cognitive machinery or states, at least, that we need in order to get the ball rolling. And in terms of the mechanisms, you know, I have to admit that it's just a sort of working hypothesis that identifying states in this sort of informational way and functional way will actually end up being associated or localized in certain ways in the human brain. And I guess what I have to say about that is just that we don't know anything about the physical mechanism yet. And for all I know or for all I argue, it might turn out that they are like immensely distributed across the brain or the nervous system or whatever. But I do think it's still very helpful as a methodological tool. It gets us away from conceptual analysis, for example, to just, you know, form our hypotheses in this particular way.
So at least at this point, we don't know anything about the neuroscience that might be behind all of this.
Well, you know, I don't want to go quite that far because we know something about the brain, how it works, and we know a lot about the kind of analogies we can make between what I'm positing and other things. That's why one of the things that I do in the book a lot is sort of draw an analogy between research on memory and research on what I'm calling pragmatic competence. And I just think memory research in psychology was helped a lot with this kind of project where you started off with functional hypotheses about what the mechanism would be for if it's there, and you fight it out between different hypotheses. You don't just say, well, it doesn't have any function, or it has like 10 or whatever. You just, you know, form camps and argue, I guess.
Yeah. So one thing that we haven't talked about yet is self-directed speech. So does Edenic intentionalism also apply there?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've been thinking more about that lately. It does play an important role in the argument in the book, because I want to say that self-directed speech is one of these things that people have used to intuitively just not be bothered too much with the intentionalist theory, because it sounds so utterly implausible for the self-directed case. You know, we talk to each other a lot, but we don't have these self-directed intentions, right? But I think there is a very good reason to think that that's just wrong. So here's an intuitive way to think about it. It's definitely true for some sets of self-directed speech, some types of cases, that they're just literally self-directed speech acts in the intentionalist sense. And one way, at least when I, you know, start teaching this to undergrads to get the ball rolling, I say something like, just imagine that you're standing in front of the mirror and you're supposed to give a very important speech tomorrow, and you start rehearsing, which is another way we, you know, produce speech which is not directed to anybody and not obviously to ourselves either. Well, it's sort of unclear. So you start by looking in the mirror and you say, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. But then you stop and say, no, Elmar, don't say ladies and gentlemen. That sounds awful. You should start somehow some other way. And there is this fascinating difference between what I just did there. You know, I was rehearsing speech first, but then I stopped myself and I started, you know, bemoaning myself, or, you know, instructing myself or directing myself in certain ways. And I don't think it's possible really to make plausible sense of this unless we just think about it in the normal way in which we try to influence each other. So I do think a lot of the things that we do when we direct our own speech to ourselves is actually just recruiting our capacities to influence others by performing speech acts. But I have to say, just to finish this off, I still think there are many, many different ways in which language or language use might have these non-communicative or cognitive functions or benefits, at least. But I guess what I'm saying is that, yeah, if somebody wants to go for the functional hypothesis that I'm sort of trying to use as my guide, it seems to me that most of the evidence, empirical evidence about this, suggests that you might just as well explain those cognitive functions or benefits as derivative from maybe the more primary function of communication. But it is important also to say that I'm talking about pragmatic competence, and because language, that word can mean very different things. I don't want anybody to think that by that I mean that, you know, a Chomskyan language faculty necessarily must have a communicative function in some sense. Like I think that's a bigger debate to be had.
Mm-hmm. So my last question then, what would you say are some of the main challenges to your theory?
Right. I guess I think there is a lot to say there, which I'm happy about, because it makes it easy for me to have more projects in the future. But we did mention the thing that I guess is most obvious, which is just this point about localization, and in what sense exactly I'm talking about dedicated mechanisms that are somehow designed or have evolved even in humans in order to achieve the benefits of human interpersonal communication. Because it's very common to argue against this and say something like, well, what you're identifying is just identical to something much broader. Like what we are using when we are communicating is just our general capacities for reasoning, thinking, inference to the best explanation, and things like that. And that's a sort of challenge to me, but I think it's a very fruitful challenge because, as I indicated before or mentioned briefly, I think this is something where we just don't have the relevant information yet to decide which of these ways of going is actually true. And I happen to think that what most of the things that I say about the mechanism will turn out to be, things you can easily still cling on to if the more general hypothesis about this just being some reasoning capacity turns out to be true. And some of my more recent papers, especially about the differences between sincerity and insincerity, and the differences between assertives and directives or imperatives, I think I've discovered some evidence to the to think that it's at least a fruitful way to go on to try to theorize about the human pragmatic linguistic capacity, because it gives us ways to argue and theorize which are very disassociated to a certain way of analyzing concepts or being very non-attached or not happy with your theory being potentially falsified by empirical results. So I guess that's the really big challenge for my theory. But there are, of course, many, many smaller things that are very challenging as well, which I could get into. But I think it's nice to leave off with a sort of bigger thing.
Fair enough. So the book is again talking about an annotationalist theory of reference, and I'm leaving a link to it in the description box of this interview. Dr. Unstensen, just before we go, would you also like to tell people apart from the book where they could find you and your work on the internet?
Yeah, you can look me up on Twitter. And I also have a website, which is unstenson.com. I try to keep that updated. There's a website there, or part of that website, which is now dedicated to the book and responses to the book and stuff like that. I also have a Phil People, profile, which is fairly well updated. And so I'm hoping it's very easy to follow what I'm writing and stuff, because sometimes it can be hard to update all those things whenever you do something. But yeah, I think you can find all those things fairly easily.
Okay, great. I'm adding that to the description box of the interview as well. And thank you so much again for taking the time to come on the show. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Ricardo. Thank you so much for inviting me. It was a lot of fun. Thanks. Ricardo, thank you so much for inviting me. It was a lot of fun. Thanks.
Hi guys, thank you for watching this interview until the end. If you like what I'm doing, please do not forget to share, like, subscribe, comment, and to keep the channel sustainable, please consider supporting it on Patreon or PayPal. You can find the links in the description box of the interview. This show is brought to you by Enlights Learning and Development Done Differently. Check their website at enlights.com. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and PayPal supporters, Perga Larsen, Jerry Mueller, Hans Frederick Sunde, Bernard Seixas, Olaf, Alex, Adam Kessel, Matthew Wintingberg, Arno Wolf, Tim Hollison, Eric Alenia, John Connors, Philip Force Connolly, Dan Demetriou, Robert Windegger, Rui Nassi, Zup, Marco Neves, Colin Holbrook, Simon Columbus, Phil Kavanagh, Mikkel Stormir, Samuel Andreev, Francis Ford, Tiago Nunes, Fergal Cussen, Halle Herzog, Nuno Machado, Jonathan Librant, João Linhares, Stanton T, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, João Oeira, Tom Hummel, Sardus France, David Sloan Wilson, Yassir Ladez Araújo, Romain Roach, Diego Londoño Correa, Yannick Punter, Adana Rusmani, Charlotte Bliss, Nicole Barbaro, Adam Hunt, Pavel Ostaszewski, Nelek Bak, Guy Madison, Gary G. Ellman, Sam Afzal, Adrian Yeager, Paulo Tolentino, João Barbosa, Julian Price, Edward Hall, Edwin Bronner, Douglas Fry, Franca Bortolotti, Gabriel Pons Cortez, Ursula Litzke, Scott, Zachary Fish, Tim Duffy, Sonny Smith, John Wiseman, Daniel Friedman, William Buckner, Paul George Arnault, Luke Louwaki, Georgios Theofanos, Kurizil Williamson, Peter Walosin, David Williams, Diogo Costa, Anton Eriksson, Charles Murray, Alex Shaw, Amaury Martinez, Coralie Chevalier, Bangalore Athis, Larry D. Lee Jr., Old Erringbon, Sterry, Michael Bailey, Dan Sperber, Robert Gressi, Igor N., Jeff McMahon, Jake Zuhl, Barnabas Radix, Mark Campbell, Thomas Dobner, Luke Neeson, Chris Story, Kimberly Johnson, Benjamin Galbert, Jessica Nowicki, Linda Brandin, Nicholas Carlson, Ismael Benzliman, George Coriatis, Valentin Steinman, Per Krollis, Kate Von Goller, Alexander Hubbard, Liam Dunaway, BR, Masood Ali Mohammadi, Perpendicular, and Jonas Hurtner. A special thanks to my producers, Isaiah Webjim, Frank Lucas Tafinia, Tom Vanagden, Bernard Hugni, Curtis Dixon, Benedict Mueller, Thomas Trumbull, Catherine and Patrick Tobin, John Carlo Montenegro, Al Nick Ortiz, and Nick Golden. And to my executive producers, Matthew Lavender, Sergio Codrian, and Bogdan Canivets. Thank you for all.